Okay, good evening, everyone. We will make a start. Welcome to Kabbalah Part 2. We have a smaller crowd on Zoom tonight, a few people on Facebook, so let's get right into it. So last week we addressed the obsession with food that Jewish people seem to have. We talked about how every yontiv, every chag is connected with another food. There's a lot of laws not to us surrounding food, and so on and so forth. So we talked about this idea that in the Torah we find the word holiness, the word kedusha, specifically around things that are very physical, primarily food and sexuality. And we talked about that concept, that that is really the mission of creation, the uniqueness of the Jewish religion, that we are able to tap into a very special energy that is found specifically in the lowest form of existence, i.e. the physical and the mundane, and we're able to connect to it and become elevated and stronger by it, provided we do it with a focus, with a way that God directs us to do it and guides us to do it and so forth. And we broke it down a bit specifically with regard to food, that we learned Kabbalistically, a very Kabbalistic idea about the world of chaos that preceded the world of order, Tohu, which preceded Tikkun. And we talked about the very powerful energy of chaos, the passion, the strong energy of chaos that fell down. And as a result, we have the concept of the nitzutzot, the sparks of godliness that are trapped within the physical and the mundane. And the physical hunger that we have is really triggered by a spiritual hunger to release those sparks. In other words, those sparks come from a very high source, which is why they fall lower. They are found in the parts of creation that are lower than the human being, i.e. the mineral, the vegetation, and the animal kingdom. And when we can release those sparks and connect to them, then those sparks can elevate us to levels which we couldn't achieve on our own. However, if we don't connect to it in the correct way, not only are we not able to release those sparks and elevate them, but what happens is the energy of this intense energy of the world of chaos that is in those foods that we eat actually draw us down and are destructive spiritually more than beneficial. Which is why we talked about eating with a spiritual mindfulness, eating with a focus, eating in the way that we eat things that are able to be elevated, such as the concept of kashrut. We make a blessing before understanding where the food comes from, reflecting on why we're eating, using the energy. It's not just about pleasure seeking, but it's about using the energy from what we eat to be able to be a better human being, to serve God in a stronger way, and using the energy, using the power from what we eat, into channeling it into a life of meaning and a life of purpose. So that was the general concept. We went into great detail last week, but the general concept of eating Kabbalistically. Today, what I want to do is I want to tackle three specific ideas. Maybe four, sort of, which have to do with food and eating. The first two will be having a look at some of the laws of kashrut and understanding them from a Kabbalistic point of view. We'll do that. We'll do one and two of that. Then we'll have a look at the concept of wine. Wine seems to play a very important role in the Jewish ritual, in the Jewish religion, the Jewish practice. Understanding, apart from the general concept of eating and releasing the sparks and elevating the food and becoming elevated in the process, wine seems to have a special role, and we need to understand what that is. And if we have time, we're going to go to the idea of matzah and understand the spiritual energy in the matzah, Kabbalistically, and what it does when we eat it properly on the mitzvah of Pesach night, and so on and so forth. So let's begin. Let's have a look, first of all, at animals that are kosher. What is the idea behind that? So we know that the Torah gives us two signs to determine which animals are kosher and which are not. The two signs are ma'alei gera, which means to chew the cud, and the second sign is shasa chesa, which is split hoofs, right? So chewing the cud and split hoofs. So, there's a great halachic debate. Let's start off with the halachic perspective, then we're going to go to the Kabbalistic. What does the Torah mean that the Torah tells us the signs of a kosher animal. In other words, it can be understood two ways. Is it that there are certain animals that God decided are kosher and certain animals that are not? And it happens to be that all the animals that are kosher fall into one category. They all happen to have the signs of chewing the cud and complete split hoofs, which means that's just a good way to tell which animals are kosher and which animals are not. In other words, it's not that the split hooves and the chewing the cud is intrinsically the cause of kashrut, but it's just more of a sign to know which animals happen to be kosher, because they all seem to share a common sign, which is convenient for us to use that as a mark of identification. But on a deeper level, and this is a halachic concept as well, we are taught that no, it's not that they happen to be share equal marks of identification, but in fact, it's the chewing of the cud and the splitting of the hoofs that are in fact the cause of what makes the animal kosher. It is those signs that create the kosherness, the kashrut of the animal. And what does that mean? Why is that? So one of the ideas is that when we eat meat, which meat plays a role in Jewish practice, we're supposed to eat some sort of meat, can be poultry, even on Shabbat. On Yom Tov, there's even a greater mitzvah to eat meat. During the temple times, there was commandments to eat certain sacrificial meats, particularly the paschal lamb on the night of Pesach by the Seder, and so on. But the meat is not just the animal. The meat represents something within us. It represents the animal which we all contain within us. As we know, the famous Hasidic idea, Kabbalistic idea, that we all contain two sides, we contain two souls. One is the animal, the one is the godly soul, known in Kabbalah as the Nefesh Elokit, the godly soul. The other one is the Nefesh Habamit, the animal side, the animalistic sides, the animalistic tendencies that we have, the animalistic soul. We are taught that the animalistic soul that we have is not intrinsically bad, but it tends and it leans, it's disposed towards egocentricity, pursuit of pleasure, self-preservation, self-indulgence. But it also contains a very strong energy and a strong power to be channeled and transformed to enhance the process of a divine connection. So it's up to us, using the guidance of the soul, the godly soul, giving the godly soul mastery over the animal soul, to influence and to guide and to inspire and to impact the animalistic tendencies that we have, in order to channel the animal energy, the animal power, the animal passion that we contain, because the animal soul is primarily strong emotional energy, to channel that in the direction of using it to enhance the life of godliness, the life of meaning, the life of divine purpose. And what the Torah is telling us is that in order to create the kashrut, in order to create the kosherness of the animal, the physical animal that we eat, but also the animal that we contain, in order to channel our animal, there are two things that we need. Two signs. And those two signs create the kashrut, create the kosherness of the animal. The first is chewing the cud. What's chewing the cud symbolic of? Chewing the cud means to chew food, to swallow it, then bring it up, chew it again. And what it represents, we are taught in Kabbalah, represents the idea of constant reflection and review. In other words, when we act impulsively without reflection, without contemplation, without review, often the impulses that we have direct us to act in ways which are just impulsive, animalistic, and self-centered. In order to live a life of a greater meaning and divine purpose, we need to bring in the power of thought. We need to bring in the power of being thinking through our decisions, reviewing them, reflecting upon them, checking in on them to make sure that they are indeed in line with our values, in line with a higher purpose, in line with a godly direction and godly guidance. Right? That's what chewing the cud represents, that constant review. Because we are taught that moach shalit al halev. See, the animal soul is intrinsically emotional. The animal soul acts impulsively, selfishly. It gives into temptation very easily. The only way to control our emotions are very hard to change. But the only way to ensure that the emotions respond in the correct way, it's a little bit like in modern day literature, the works of Stephen Covey based on Viktor Frankl, where we talk about we have the outside stimulus and then we have our emotional response to what is going on outside of us. Chocolate cake on the table, outside stimulus. Impulsive reaction, response, let's eat it, it tastes good. Might be unhealthy, but it tastes good. Immediate response. Between stimulus and response, there's a pause. Or we need to create that pause, as Stephen Covey says in his Seven Habits based on the works of Viktor Frankl. That pause gives us time to think, to use the power of intellect to make a decision, to use the power of thinking, cognition, to guide our emotions and to have self-control and to say, no, this is good, this isn't good, this decision is good, this decision isn't good, this substance is healthy, this substance is unhealthy, and so on. So that comes from thinking, reviewing, rechecking in. If we're not sure, speaking to someone else, having a spiritual mentor, having a friend that we can confide in, we can discuss it, we can reflect it. And that's the concept, the spiritual idea of chewing the cud. That's the first sign that creates kashrut, that creates a kosher animal within us as well. The second is split hooves. Split hooves have two things. In order to be kosher, an animal, number one, must have a hoof, which means it must be slightly raised from the ground, symbolizing the idea of detaching a little bit from earthliness, not being immersed in mundaneness, in something which is earthly, which is physical and mundane, but creating a distance between us and the mundane so that we can elevate a little bit. We can look higher, we can elevate ourselves to a higher purpose. That is the concept of having a hoof to begin with. But the test of a kosher hoof is one that is split. A split hoof means there are two sides to the hoof. What does that symbolize? It symbolizes something we've spoken about before, and that is, we know that we have seven emotions: chesed, gvura, tiferet, netzach, hod yisod. And we know the two primary forces of our emotional structure is the idea of chesed and gevura. Chesed is love, flexibility, attraction, connection, giving, kindness, and so on and so forth. Gevura is more restraint, discipline, harshness when needed, firmness, structure, organization. It's all got to do with gevura, holding back, not just indulging. And we know that we are taught that chesed and gevura, although the connotation of chesed is always positive, sometimes the connotation of gevura is negative. But in truth, both are important. There's good chesed and bad chesed. There's good gevura and bad gevura. Just to give you an example, we've given many times, you can have good chesed. Good chesed means I just connect to anything. It might be bad for me. It might be unhealthy for me. I connect to any bad and unhealthy toxic relationship. I connect to any I like, and I really am attracted to any good food, even though it will taste good, even though it's bad for me. That's bad chesed. Although good chesed, of course, is the idea of giving and loving, true love, and really, you know, going out of our way to connect to someone else and or connect to God and so on and so forth. Gevura is the same thing. Gevura is holding back. Holding back can be rejection. It can be aggression where I reject someone else. All of that is part of bad gevura, but there's also good gevura. Good gevura is self-control. Good gevura is being limited to something. I've always said, if you want to run a project, if you want to lift to the airport at 3 o'clock in the morning, you ask a chesed person. If you want to run a project and you need someone to be loyal, organized, and structured, you ask a gevura person. Right? So chesed and gevura are both necessary and both good and both bad. But here's the point. Every person has a disposition to either chesed or gevura. Most of us are leaning towards chesed people or gevura people. But part of growth and part of the sign that we are not being self-centered and self-serving, but we are living a life that is dedicated to the greater good, is the ability to bring in that part of the personality that is difficult for us. Meaning to have both chesed and gevura. When needed, to have chesed. Let's give an example. Tolerance is a chesed response. Very, very important response. Intolerance is always seen as bad. It is bad. But sometimes we have to be intolerant. The chesed person who's always so loving and giving and accepting and kind needs to sometimes stand up and say, no, this is evil. I'm going to reject it. I'm going to be intolerant of it because it's evil. Giving is a great thing to give to others, but when we give to a child and spoil a child, some parents are so hard for them to say no because they're just chesed people. They love giving. Hard for them to say no, so they give the child and spoil the child in the process. Sometimes we have to learn to hold back. Every part of serving God has certain parts which are chesed, loving, beautiful concepts. And then the Torah gives us a lot of things that we cannot do. We have to exercise self-control. The Torah tells us sometimes we have to stand up and punish the evil, and that is part of gevurah. We need both things. Therefore, to be really a kosher animal, we need to be able to do both. That's the split hoofs, both sides. When needed, it needs to be chesed. When needed, it needs to be gevurah. Because that's a sign that it's not us. Sometimes it needs to be the combination of both, known as tiferet, which is the harmony, the synthesis of both. My famous example, simple example, is this. Because when you're able to do both, that shows that you're not doing it because it's you. You're not responding from your world, what works for you and what is selfishly yours, but you're responding in a way that needs to be done. You're responding with the truth. You're responding with the moral, with the ethics of what needs to happen, not what you want to happen. That's a sign of selflessness, and that's a sign of true growth, and that's a sign of kashrut. Give me a simple example. You're walking down the street, and there's a homeless person, looks very hungry, comes out to you and says, can you spare $5? And you suspect on good grounds that $5 is not going to be used for food, it's going to be used for unhealthy substances. Let's say. You have good reason to believe. The chesed person can't say no. A person who's imbued with chesed just loves to give, hard to refuse, and they can never say no, just takes $5 out of the pocket and gives it to the homeless person. And who knows what the consequences of that will be. The gevurah person couldn't care less. Very easy for them to say no. It can be very firm and harsh. Just says, get lost. I'm not giving you the $5. I'm giving you a very simplistic example. Obviously, it's much more complicated than that. I'm just bringing out a point, right? But the gevurah person says, no way. Just leave me alone. And that's, who knows what the consequences of that could be. It's a hungry person, has nothing to eat. Both of these responses are coming from people's personality, from people's nature, what they want, what works for them, not what works for the truth or the greater good. So what works for them is sort of a selfish kind of perspective. What works for the greater good is more selfless. I'm not worried about what I'm feeling, I'm worried about what is important. So you have the tiferet person who's able to exercise both chesed and gevurah. And the tiferet person turns to the homeless person and says, no, I'm not going to give you $5, but please come with me across the road to that corner store and I'll buy you a sandwich. Sandwich could cost more than $5. What that person is doing is chesed and gevurah. Saying no to the $5, but taking the person across to buy him a sandwich, which is great chesed. That's a selfless response. That's responding not what I'm feeling. It's not broadcasting my emotions. It's more responding to what needs to happen rather than what I want to happen. That is selfless. That's another sign of kashrut. So therefore, that's a sign when a person can do that. When a person can do that, which means a person can nurture their own personality and nature, but at the same time they can incorporate that which is difficult for them, that which is not their natural personality, when needed and when it's important, that's the sign of a kosher animal, that's the sign of a kashrut of a kosher animal. So those are the two signs, that's the Kabbalistic idea behind kosher animals and what constitutes a kosher animal and what isn't. Another little aspect of kashrut is the prohibition of meaning meat, mixing meat and milk. Here, there's an interesting idea which is symbolized here, which is very fascinating. We're not supposed to mix meat and milk, and in the Torah's context, the original prohibition was more about cooking them together. By extension, we're not permitted to eat meat and milk, even if they're still separate things, and kind of a chicken and salami sandwich and so on and so forth. But the original concept was about not cooking them together. Lo tevashel, the Torah says, do not cook a goat in its mother's milk. What's the idea? You know, it's fascinating that we find in the Torah a number of prohibitions where we find that one shouldn't mix things that are different together. For For example, there's a prohibition of Torah of called shatnez, when he's not supposed to wear a garment that has both wool and linen in it. When he's not supposed to plow a field with an ox and a donkey, two different types of animals. When he's not supposed to breed different animals together. When he's not supposed to plant certain different seeds together. For example, one cannot plant wheat and grapes, grape seeds in the same furrow, the same earth, same hole. So we find many instances where that is the case. And the question is asked, the question is raised. It's an interesting perspective that Torah doesn't allow us sometimes to mix certain things. Because isn't that a sign of unity? Isn't mixing things together a unifying process? Screwed, you mix two different seeds together, make a hybrid fruit. Ox and a donkey learning to get on with each other. Wool and linen representing Kabbalistic different forces coming together. Why not? Meat and milk, for that matter. And indeed, meat and milk represent the same two things we spoke about before. Kabbalistically, meat is a sign of gevura. It's red, it's fiery, it's the idea of gevura, strength. Milk, which is sort of more representative of a mother feeding a baby, that's white and it's pure and it's soft, is representative of chesed, kindness, giving. And yet we don't bring them together. Why? So there's a concept that's talked about in the mystical writings that the truth is, achdut, coming together, is actually very, very important. It's one of the ideals of Judaism, unity. But what does that mean, coming together? So we are taught that there are two conditions that need to be met to create unity that is beneficial and is of value. First of all, the coming together must be for a higher purpose. When people are just united, they can be united for something wrong. Unity is only good and creates an amazing force when the unity is subject to higher values. Secondly, and importantly for this discussion, unity is good when the distinctiveness of each component remains intact. That's very important. We find that in relationships. All relationships are the concept of unity. Relationships is when two very different things come together. Two very different people come together. Men and women in marriage. Different kinds of friends, teachers and students. Very different people with different perspectives come together. And one of the things we know about a healthy relationship is that when two people come together, the individuality needs to remain intact. When one dilutes or suffocates the other, that's not a healthy relationship. So relationship, yes, we talk about two half souls, for example, in marriage becoming one, but it's not becoming one. It means two half souls that each have a uniqueness, and the uniqueness remains intact. And they work together, they cooperate with each other, they learn from each other, they complement each other. That's true unity. Therefore, we bring together powers of the soul. Each power has its unique mission. Each personality, each component has its unique purpose. Bringing chesed and gevurah together, particularly in its original form of prohibition, to cook them all together until they become one stew, not being able to discern and know exactly what is meat, what is milk, that's a prohibition. Bringing flax and wool together in one garment, creating one tree out of two seeds, that's all different. That's not a good unity. That's a unity where the individuality merges into one bigger concept, and therefore the individuality is diluted and disappears. So that's another concept of chesed and gevurah, because we need to understand chesed on its own, gevurah on its own, to know when to use what, to know when to bring them together, but still know what part of what we're doing is chesed, what part of what we're doing is gevurah. When they all become one, it becomes confusing, misleading, and really that's not true, true unity. And that sheds light on this idea of chesed and gevurah coming, not being able to come together in that way, in the way of basar b'chalav, meat and milk. Okay. Let's get on to wine. Wine has a lot to talk about. And wine, from time immemorial, was considered a very significant drink, a prominent beverage, and is used in every significant Jewish ritual. On Shabbat and Chagim, we make Kiddush. At the end of Shabbat and Yom Tov, we make Havdalah. By a brit, we make a blessing over a cup of wine. We praise God over a cup of wine. By a wedding, we use wine twice. In the chuppah, two different cups of wine. Many, many times, sometimes we bench with wine. Wine is a very, very used thing. Of course, on Pesach, we have four cups of wine. And then we have Purim. Purim that we are taught, in fact, that the joy and the celebration is so immense and so significant that we are commanded to drink wine to the point of becoming a little intoxicated. What does that all mean? What's the purpose? So, while generally eating food is the process of releasing those sparks, as we spoke about last week, elevating the sparks, becoming elevated from the sparks, that's all very important, and that's generally all eating, all forms of eating. But then there are certain types of eating which are more significant than wine when it's done properly. I mean, just let's stop there for a moment and just talk about why wine is so important. Now, when we talk about wine in Jewish writings, today often grape juice is used, but that's not the original concept. In Talmudic times, they didn't have grape juice. I mean, unless they squeezed fresh grapes and just drank it, but there wasn't that concept of grape juice. Grape juice is, it does the trick, and it's symbolic of wine, but actually, when we talk about wine in Jewish observance, it means alcoholic wine. Now, just let's talk about the view of alcohol. Alcohol can be very damaging, as we know. When people drink in excess, sometimes they lose themselves, they do silly things, they make bad decisions. They can be violent, they can be destructive. They can lose control, they can say things they shouldn't say. And sometimes it's just a very empty and not a very pleasant experience. And yet here we come and the Torah says, Pesach na, drink four cups of wine. Purim, drink a lot of wine till you get intoxicated. So great. What does the Gemara want? What does the Talmud want from us to get completely plastered and just sort of act crazy, lose control? In Judaism, losing control is considered a bad thing. So what does it mean? But we know that there's a good side to alcohol. Alcohol drunk in the right way with the right focus, because even joy and happiness needs to be focused. Even the joy of Purim has to be very focused. Now, it's not a Purim shiur, but the Purim happiness, actually, when one understands Purim at a deeper level, it's a very serious thing. It's a focused joy. It's a deep joy. It's a joy that needs reflection and focus and understanding. And joy breaks barriers. And that's the concept of wine. The idea of wine is about revealing hidden energy. There's that famous saying, Nichnas yayin yetze sod. When wine enters, the secrets come out. Now, that could be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on what the secrets are. When a person is happy, or a person sometimes has a little l'chaim and a kiddush for a good reason, people sit together, have a little fabrengen, and they say a little bit of l'chaim, sometimes it loosens up people up and greater feelings come out. Greater insights come out. There were great tzaddikim that would sometimes say a little bit of l'chaim, drink some alcohol, particularly on Purim, and the result was a very different result. The result was the revelation and the teaching of great secrets, tremendous ideas. Like, that's the concept of wine, right? The grape is a fruit, but the fruit is just a superficial, it's a pleasure thing. Now, this idea is brought out a lot by the custom of making kiddush on wine on Friday nights. According to many opinions, the original sin, the sin of the eating of the garden, the fruit from the tree of knowledge in the Garden of Eden, that Adam and Eve did as a loss of self-control without waiting. According to many opinions, that fruit was in fact a grape, which represents the very depth of this whole idea. A grape is not bad, but a grape is like a fruit. A fruit can be used just for pleasure. And that's what happened to Adam and Eve. The Talmud tells us that had Adam and Eve waited a few hours, they were created on Friday afternoon. Had they waited for a few hours, they would have been able to make wine out of the grapes and drink it on Shabbat. That whole prohibition was only for a few hours. What's the idea behind that? The pasuk, the verse tells us in Bereshit, in Genesis, that Eve saw and Adam saw that the fruit was delicious. So they took it. They took it as a pleasure experience. And that was their downfall. Because that grape had hidden in it the pleasure, which is superficial as pleasure always is. But that grape had in it the potential to make wine, a hidden potential to make wine. Wine has the ability to uncover that which is hidden, to bring out the depth behind that is hiding behind the superficial, to bring out the purpose of creation. When you look at the world, it looks just something very physical and pleasurable, but if you go deeper, there's a purpose to it, there's a meaning to it. And that's the idea that they had to wait till Shabbat would come. Shabbat would reveal the meaning. Shabbat would reveal the purpose of creation. And then it would become mutar, become permissible to drink the wine. Which is why some commentators explain why we still have the mitzvah of Kiddush on Friday night. The mitzvah of Kiddush on Friday night is we take that very fruit that was eaten by Adam and Eve where they messed up and we make Kiddush over it, showing that we are bringing a tikkun, we bring a correction. We are correcting and fixing what the original sin was all about. They ate it for pleasure, but we're taking the very same grape and we're using it for a higher purpose, using it to make Kiddush over, to make a blessing over, to welcome in the Shabbat, to sanctify the Shabbat, and so on. Using this idea, I want to share with you an insight that was once explained by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, decoding a fascinating, cryptic, complicated piece of the Talmud. And I'm sharing it with particular emphasis because in a couple of weeks is the Festival of Purim. So we know that the Gemara, the Talmud, of course, has to be studied and understood. And sometimes the Talmud, which is primarily legalistic, sometimes tells us stories, philosophical ideas, which often are written in a cryptic way, and we need to uncover their true meaning. So the Talmud tells us a story about Purim. And this comes after the Talmud introduces this mitzvah to drink wine on Purim. That the happiness of Purim is so great, we should drink wine. It says, Chayav inish lipsumei, a person should become slightly intoxicated on Purim. And Rashi says, what does that mean? It means to drink wine. Some people drink other alcohol, but drink wine, right? And following on from that law about drinking wine on Purim, the Talmud tells us the following story. There were two great Talmudic sages. They lived around the 13th century. Lived around the 3rd century, 4th century. Two great Talmudic sages known as Rabba and Rab Zeira. Two great, the greatest of the great, unbelievable Talmudic sages. Great mystics, great people. Rabba and Rab Zeira. I'm emphasizing the name because you'll see the names are relevant to the discussion. And Rabba, now I'm just going to tell you the way the Talmud reads. Rabba invited Rab Zeira to the Purim festive meal. They drank wine, became intoxicated. Rabba got up, and this is what it says, V'shachte l'Rab Zeira. He shechted, translated as slaughtered, like a shoichet, Rab Zeira. The next day, he sobered up, so to speak, he saw what he had done. He davened to Hashem and brought Rab Zeira back to life. The next year, Purim, Rabba invited Rab Zeira once again for the Purim meal. And Rab Zeira politely declined, thank you, but no thank you. Because, Lav b'chol shatar yisrachish nisa, says the Talmud, not every year can I rely on a miracle to revive me. So of course, if we read the story just as it reads, it's full of questions. Today, if someone got drunk and shechted someone else, slaughtered someone else, it would be manslaughter, at the very least. Yet, it seems that we're talking about Rabba. Rabba was a great tzaddik. It seems like the next day he still had the spiritual power, the spiritual level, to bring Rab Zeira back to life. Someone who's just transgressed manslaughter, we imagine would lose some of that spiritual power. Rabba remained Rabba. He remained the great tzaddik. He remained devout. He remained righteous. He remained dedicated to Torah mitzvot. He wasn't demoted. He wasn't thrown out of the yeshiva. He wasn't put into prison. He wasn't done anything like that. And the next year he invites Reb Zeira again. One would think he would reflect on what happened last year. One would think at least the invitation would be, please come to my Purim Seder and I promise you we won't even taste alcohol this year. But no, Talmud doesn't say that. In fact, Reb Zeira knew that wouldn't be the case. Reb Zeira knew that even in Rabbah's new Purim meal, the next year, the following year, the practice of drinking wine would continue. And he was worried. He didn't want to be miraculously revived afterwards. So what does this mean? What does all this mean? There are those that interpret the Talmud didn't actually mean he killed him. Of course he didn't kill him. He just gave him a bit too much and he felt unwell. But it's interesting that the Talmud does use the expression of v'shachte, that he's slow, ishachte. So at one Purim gathering, the Rebbe explained the following idea. Based on what we said before, drinking wine, as every eating, can be and should be, and is particularly with great people, much more of a spiritual experience than it is a physical experience. Remember, the Baal Shem Tov said that when we are hungry, it's a spiritual hunger that is triggering a physical hunger, so that the person should connect to the sparks, the divine sparks that are found within the food. The more powerful the food, the more powerful the experience. Drinking wine, for Rabbah, was not a happy experience. It wasn't just getting happy. Drinking wine for Rabbah and Rabbah Zeira, particularly when it was a festival like Purim, which has a lot of kedusha, a lot of holiness in it, a lot of divinity in it. When a tzaddik, when someone is on a very high mystical level, drinks wine, it's not a exercise in getting drunk. It's an exercise in bringing out the deepest part of the soul. It's an exercise in revealing the greatest secrets of Torah. There are many, many stories like this with tzaddikim, with great righteous people, that actually when they drank wine, particularly on Purim, they were actually transported to a whole other world. I will tell you a story with the Lubavitcher Rebbe himself. In 1958, it was a very famous Purim. The Rebbe had a Fabrengen, and the Fabrengen would work, that they would sing and then he would talk, and they would sing and then he would talk. And he would share insights, he would share ideas, the deep ideas of Hasidic insight, Kabbalah, halachic stuff, whatever the case might be. And in that particular Purim, 1958, Tafshin Chai, the Rebbe came into the Fabrengen and it was Purim, and he said L'chaim, and he said a lot of L'chaim. And as he said more L'chaim, he started to reveal deeper and deeper Torah. There's a recording of it. It's an amazing, amazing Fabrengen. It went till the morning. Started at 9:30 at night and finished at 6:30 a.m. And as he drank more, different to most people, yes, it became harder for him to do it. It made him physically tired. But actually, the Torah, the teachings that he started to teach, was deeper and deeper, very structured, very deep, very insightful, very elevating. It was as if he was transported to a whole other world, started to reveal deepest things that normally he wouldn't reveal, because he connected to the spiritual power of wine. Wine comes in, secrets come out. For some people, that's bad news. That's just a very empty thing. They say things they would never say. Sometimes you're getting it later. With a tzaddik, with a great person, drinking wine is a spiritual experience, even though it's a physical act, but it becomes a spiritual process where great secrets come out. They're actually able to really reveal deeper part of their soul and deeper part of their Torah teachings. Incidentally, with that particular Purim, although the Rebbe explained such beautiful things and such deep things, he actually asked, he called in some of the two Hasidim a few days later and asked them to repeat some of the things that he had taught, because he says that after the second talk, he doesn't remember anything anymore. Not because he was drunk, because he was teaching most amazing things, but because he was transported to a different world and the Torah teachings that he was teaching was coming from a different planet, a different reality. And then when he returned back, kind of wasn't there anymore. So he asked what it was, whatever the reason is. So he explained, going back to the story of these two great Talmudic sages. out of those two Talmudic sages, Rabbah was the greater one. Now remember their names, Rabbah and Rab Zeira. Great, two great tzaddikim. But Rabbah, the word Rabbah means great. The word Zeira means small. Because Rab Zeira was small in comparison to Rabbah. So they drank wine and they started to embark on the spiritual Kabbalistic journey, tasting and being exposed to the deepest concepts of the soul and Torah teachings. And Rabbah, being the greater of the two, exposed and revealed such deep ideas, such revealed such esoteric concepts, that they became too overwhelming, too holy, too powerful for Rab Zeira, to the point where, as we find in Chumash, with great tzaddikim, that they reached such levels of ecstasy, of divine connection. For Rabbah, it was too powerful, and he wasn't able to contain his soul in the body, and the soul actually left the body. But Rabbah, being this, the great Rabbah that he was, brought the soul back into the body. And this is the meaning of the Talmudic expression, "Come, Rabbah." Rabbah got up and he shechted Rab Zeira. The word shechted can mean slaughter, but the word shechted also means, as explained in Kabbalistic writings, that when we shecht an animal, we slaughter an animal. It's actually a process of elevation. V'shachat izu mashach. To shecht means to pull, to transform, to elevate. It's another whole other discussion, but that's what it means. And therefore, when Rabbah got up and shechted Rab Zeira, he didn't kill him in the sense of murder. It means he elevated him. But he elevated him to such a high level, a level that Rab Zeira couldn't contain within himself. So then the obvious question is, Rabbah saw what happened. Rabbah saw that his teachings were too much for Rab Zeira. So why did he invite him again the next year? So the answer is because Rabbah invited Rab Zeira because he figured that during the year, Rab Zeira had upgraded his spiritual level, and perhaps this Purim, he's ready now to receive and to absorb that intense spiritual and esoteric journey without being challenged to separate his soul from his body. Sounds like a good plan. So then why did Rab Zeira refuse? Rab Zeira refused because he knew that he had indeed grown over the years. He was different now. He was much higher, perhaps ready to take much more. But he figured Rabbah had also grown. So the gap between them still remained the same. And therefore he was worried and declined the invitation. So that's the Kabbalistic meaning of that story of drinking wine. But it's a lesson for all of us. That yes, when we come to a simcha and we are happy and it's Purim and we say a little bit of L'chaim, it needs to, at least in our level, loosen up and give us the opportunity to share deeper things, to commit to Torah mitzvot in a deeper way, to commit to a meaning of a life of meaning and purpose on a deeper level. It's not meant just to send us crazy and be wild. That's not what it's about. It's about building up a greater, deeper connection between us and God, because the energy of the wine contains that ability for us to do that if we eat and drink with a focus, as we explained last week. So that's the wine idea. I'll just briefly end off with another one, and that is matzah. There's a big mitzvah coming out of Pesach. Of course, on Pesach, we do not eat chametz, we do not eat risen bread, bread that has risen, leavened bread. But also, not only that, but there's a mitzvah, particularly on the Seder night, to eat a big piece of shmura matzah, to eat matzah. What is the idea? So, of course, simply put, because when the Jews left Egypt, they also ate matzah. They ate matzah on the night before they left. They had a Seder with the Paschal lamb. They ate matzah the next day when they left Mitzrayim. The Zohar says that matzah is called michla dim heimenuta. It's the bread of faith, the bread of surrender to God. What is matzah? Matzah has no, it doesn't rise. Symbolic of that is the idea of humility, getting rid of the ego, and submitting and surrendering to a higher power. What's the idea of eating the matzah? So we know when the Jews left Egypt, we are taught that one of the things they had tremendously strong was the emunah, the idea of faith. But faith, we are taught, can operate on two levels. There's a famous little saying, almost a joke, that a thief can break into a house, and then just before the thief is about to steal, he stops and he offers up a quick prayer to God. Please, God, let me be successful in this mission. Which is a craziness. It's an oxymoron. It's just a contradiction in terms. Here's someone is about, sounds absolutely bizarre. Someone is about to do something blatantly against the will of God, like steal, but yet believes in God and believes it's up to God if he's successful or not. And offers up a prayer to God to make him successful. Isn't that bizarre? The truth is, not that bizarre, because we all do that. We all sometimes have that cognitive dissonance where we believe in something and we certainly believe in God, but yet sometimes we do things that we know he doesn't want us to do. Why is that? Because of the very depth of each Jewish soul is an intense level of emunah, an intense level of faith. We are believers. But as Kabbalah explains, there's different ways emunah operates within our body. It could be there in a very transcendent way, makif it's called, where it's somewhat detached, we haven't internalized it, so therefore we have that emunah. It's strong, we believe, but not necessarily has become part of our identity to the point that we live each day, each hour, each minute, by that emunah, by that faith. And then there's a concept where we know we take the emunah and we bring it, what's called in Hasidut, bipnimiyut, we internalize it, make it part of who we are. When the Jews left Egypt, they were spiritually immature. Every year on Pesach, we begin that cycle once again. When we eat the matzah with the right intent, the Zohar says it's like eating faith of God. It gives us the ability, not just a symbolic remembrance. It actually has an energy within it that allows us to surrender to God and to make God part of our life and to internalize that faith and internalize that emunah. And that's the Kabbalistic idea behind eating matzah on Pesach. It's the internalization of the deep faith that we have in God, but not to leave it in a transcendent way, but to make sure that it's internalized and becomes part of who we are so that we can live our life by that faith. So that's just a couple of examples of specific ideas. We went through Kashrut, two ideas of Kashrut, split hooves, chew the cud, reflection, review, being a bit above earthliness and also having the two sides, Chesed and Gevurah. Talk about Basar B'Chalav, remembering Chesed and Gevurah. Unity is a good thing, but unity is only a good thing when it doesn't dissolve the individuality. The power of wine, a lesson to us how we enjoy the world. Yes, it's okay to enjoy the world, but it shouldn't be empty, it shouldn't be pleasure-seeking, but rather like wine, unleashing and revealing the inner essence and the inner purpose, what hides behind the surface. The great Kabbalistic journey of Rabbah and Reb Zeira, how they drank wine. And finally, the idea of eating matzah, being a bread of faith and internalizing the emunah. So thank you very much for listening and wishing everyone a good night.
Thank you.